Okay, welcome to Remarket. This is our staff-generated podcast of some of our favorite things from the week. I'm Deborah Clark, I'm the executive producer, and I'm going to go first. I'm hoping this is going to be a regular feature, a little behind-the-scenes look at how we pick some of the stories each week across the Marketplace shows. This week, I'm starting with three things that happen to be from the PM program. I won't always pick from just one show, but that is the way it's working this time around. So, first up, Monday, we all came in chattering about the story we'd seen about South by Southwest in Austin and a company that had come up with a plan for homeless hotspots. It was, homeless people wearing T-shirts wired for Wi-Fi. Yeah, seriously. So Kai interviewed the marketing firm behind the idea, and we ran that interview on Monday. And you might remember Kai was pretty rough on the guy because, let's face it, it did actually sound like an idea out of The Onion. At least that's how it seemed to us at the time. Then, lo and behold, a lot of people wrote in to say that they thought it was a great way to raise awareness about the homeless, and maybe we should actually talk to a homeless person to see how they felt about it. So, the next day, we did.
So, tell me what you think about this program. I mean, when they came to the shelter and said, listen, we've got this idea for homeless hotspots, what'd you think?
I thought it was an excellent program. I mean, it gave me a little bit of recognition, and not only that, it was a positive attitude interacting with people.
Yeah. So tell me how it works in practice. I mean, you're walking around Austin, whatever you're doing, and somebody sees your T-shirt and they've got a laptop and they say, hey, man, I need some Wi-Fi. Is that basically how it goes?
That's correct. Yes, sir. I carry a device. It was just a human satellite Wi-Fi, and we helped out quite a bit.
How's it working for you? I mean, are you making money out of this thing?
Yes, sir. I'm a people person. I like to interact. I've always been in some kind of communication. It was very nice interacting with a lot of people. I mean, I met people from Denmark. I met people from Germany, England, London.
So you've had a lot of business then?
Oh, I have had a lot of business. And the promotion was our shirts.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw our shirts or you'll play.
I've seen pictures, yeah.
Yeah, yes, sir. I mean, that's where a lot of people were kind of curious. They were very intrigued by it. At first they were kind of hesitated. But once they started talking to them, explaining your situation and explaining what we were doing, they took the time to talk to us.
And the thing that got us, actually, was the T-shirts and the headlines that you saw yesterday about, oh, my God, they're turning homeless people in Austin into Wi-Fi hotspots. And it seemed a little, right, you're chuckling, right? I mean,
yes,
it was
sir.
A little bit, wow, really?
Well, you know what, you got to understand, a lot of these guys that are here at this shelter at this point in time or in this homeless situation are educated people. I used to think of they were bums or they were too lazy to work or there was some kind of mental issue. Now I've seen a different outlook of the homeless population. I mean, this is all new to me. I've been homeless for about a month and a half in my life. And it's not what you achieve in life, sir, it's what you overcome.
So did the mainstream media get it wrong yesterday with, oh, my God, this is horrible, look what they're doing? Did we blow that?
Yes, sir. I feel like that was, yes, sir, I do. I mean, all the persons that participated in this program here at the Front Step program.
Yeah, Front Step is the shelter, right?
That's correct, yeah. Yes, sir. And every one of them enjoyed it, and they're still talking about it, and they would do it again.
Dusty White, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you very much, sir.
So here's what I love about that. I love that we talked to the homeless guy, and I also really love that we kept the conversation going with our listeners because they suggested we talk to one of the Wi-Fi hotspots directly. So we did, and I just really like that. That's why I chose it. My second pick this week, this was my big laugh of the week. So here's how we started the show on Wednesday.
This is my last day at Marketplace. After almost 11 years, first as the overnight host and now on this show, I believe I've worked here long enough to understand this place, and I can honestly say that never has economic news been more toxic.
So that was Kai taking the exact words of Greg Smith, who was the Goldman Sachs exec who resigned by writing an editorial that ran in the New York Times, and it was by far the biggest business story of the day. Everybody was doing it. And I have to say, even though I knew that Kai would never, ever actually resign that way, as I listened in my office, even I had a split second of doubt as I was listening to it. And we got so many letters and emails and tweets. I mean, even within seconds of the show, people saying, oh my gosh, Kai's resigned. This is terrible, which was actually very funny and, of course, gratifying for Kai at least. And then we came back and explored the issue with a really interesting three-way conversation.
We're going to take a minute now and dissect what Smith said and how true it might or might not be with Barry Ritholtz. He's the CEO at Fusion IQ. It's a research firm in New York City. Also, Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics. He's a regular on our morning show. Guys, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So, Josh, I heard you on the morning report this morning with Jeremy Hobson talking about this thing. And you basically said, you know what? This is the Wall Street culture. Get over it. Really?
Yeah, really. I think the op-ed itself was a little bit inflamed and overly dramatic. I think the vast majority of people that work at Goldman Sachs are good people who are trying to do the best they can. It's not necessarily a culture where they want to rip everyone's throats out.
Barry, what's your sense?
I take a little longer view and remember the days when, first of all, it's not just Goldman Sachs. It's Goldman, mm-hmm. it's Merrill, it's
right.
Morgan, UBS. It's all the big shops. And second, the change that really dramatically altered the cultures took place when they went from partnerships to publicly traded companies. And once you're a public firm, well, guess what? The number for the quarter drives everything else into a secondary position. Got to make your revenue numbers, got to hit your earnings, go, 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 whatever you got to do. And that's how you end up with a culture that places a high value on ripping the client's eyeballs out.
Josh Brown, let me pick up on that, not that image, but that idea. Isn't it in a firm's best interest to take care of its clients? And doesn't that give lie to the whole Goldman ethos?
Yes, and I think it's important that we don't talk about Goldman like it's a monolithic firm
right.
and they're only in one line of business.
Right.
It's not like Ford where they just make cars. Goldman's got areas of the business where it's very important that they execute and take care of their clients. But then there are other parts of the firm where they're moving and shaking with assets that are going from one balance sheet to the next, and they're trading as a principal against their actual clients.
Yeah. Josh, let me ask you to give Barry a poke in the eye here for a second and ask you if what he's saying isn't a little bit of false romanticism, right? He wrote this morning about how, you know, these guys used to tell great stories and it's camaraderie and mentoring and,
right.
and taking care of each other.
Well, I still think that exists today. I think that you had a culture where there was a lot more training and mentorship, but even still, that mentoring was mentoring people to come in to their own and become killers.
There's a whole lot of I'm shocked to find out this happens on Wall Street in the press today. None of this is new, man. I mean, you go back to Michael Lewis and Solomon Brothers and You're So Stupid You Could Be a Client. I mean, this has been around
forever.
That's
the point that I'm trying to make. It's not like Wall Street was the Girl Scouts and then all of a sudden a switch was flipped. You can go back even further than Michael Lewis in the 80s and the 70s. You can go back 100 some odd years. Anyone could get fleeced at any time. So to say that all of a sudden the culture's changed is a little bit naive and a little bit childish. And that's the part of Greg Smith's op-ed that I took exception with.
Barry, you know, the regular person on the street who is 3 years out of a financial crisis that almost sank the whole economy and will read probably the first two paragraphs of Greg Smith's op-ed, if that. What are they supposed to make of Wall Street now?
Well, you know, it's funny because I've been a vociferous critic of Wall Street, and I find myself in the unusual situation of defending some of what the street does that's right. And, you know, if we're going to use Goldman as an example, they used to call it, we're long-term greedy. We want to be greedy, but over a period of decades, and grow as the clients become wealthy.
Hey, Kai, I have an ironclad law of financial products.
All right.
Brown's Law of Financial Products states that the more you're compensated as the broker to sell something,
yeah.
the worse it is for the client.
Barry, what about that?
Remember the great scene in A League of Their Own where he says, this is a simple game. You hit the ball, you catch the ball, you throw the ball. Well, Wall Street should be similar. You buy good companies with strong growth and good earnings. You buy high-quality bonds with a nice dividend and little risk. And you allow time to compound over long periods.
Yes, but it's way sexier if you don't do that.
Josh Brown, he's at Fusion Analytics. He blogs at The Reform Broker, and he's a regular on our Wednesday morning report with Jeremy Hobson. Barry Ritholtz blogs at The Big Picture. He's the CEO at Fusion IQ. Guys, thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Our pleasure.
And then, finally, to end with the biggie from this week, we aired a huge story about a guy named Mike Daisy, Apple and Foxconn in China, and a whole bunch of lies. And this is just getting huge buzz, largely thanks to our reporter Rob Schmitz. He's worked his tail off on this piece, and really it's just a great, great thing for Marketplace, a good piece of reporting. So if you missed it, Here goes.
For years, reporters in China have uncovered a long list of problems showing the dark side of what it's like to work at factories that assemble Apple products. Mike Daisy claimed he encountered firsthand some of the most egregious examples of this history, all in just a 6-day trip he took to the city of Shenzhen. Here's one example from his monologue. It takes place at a meeting he had had with an illegal workers' union. He meets a group of workers who've been poisoned by the chemical N-hexane while working on the iPhone assembly line.
And all these people have been exposed. Their hands shake uncontrollably. Most of them can't even pick up a glass.
Kathy Lee, Daisy's translator in Shenzhen, was with him at this meeting. I meet her at one of the places she took Daisy, the gates of Foxconn.
Did you meet people who fit this description?
No.
So there was nobody who said that they were poisoned by hexane?
No, nobody mentioned the hexane.
I asked Kathy to confirm other details in Daisy's play, like the claim that the gates were patrolled by armed guards.
Did the guards have guns when you came here with Mike Daisy?
No, definitely no.
And with nearly every detail, the answer is the same.
No, this is not true.
Daisy claims he met underage workers at Foxconn. He says he talked to a man whose hand was twisted into a claw from making iPads. He describes visiting factory dorm rooms with beds stacked to the ceiling. But Kathy says none of this happened. Last week, together with Ira Glass, the host of This American Life, I confronted Daisy in an interview. I brought up the workers he says he met who were poisoned by N-hexane. I tell him what Kathy said. Kathy says that you did not talk to workers who were poisoned by hexane.
That's correct.
So you lied about that. That wasn't what you saw.
I wouldn't express it that way.
How would you express it?
I would say that I wanted to tell a story that captured the totality of my trip.
Did you meet workers like that, or did you just read about the issue?
I met workers in Hong Kong going to Apple protests who had not been poisoned by hexane but had known people who had been, and it was like a constant conversation that we were having about those workers.
So you didn't actually meet an actual worker who had been poisoned by hexane?
That's correct.
Daisy apologized to Ira Glass for not telling the truth to him and his listeners.
Look, I'm not going to say that I didn't take a few shortcuts in my passion to be heard, but I stand behind the work. My mistake, the mistake I truly regret, is that I had it on your show as journalism. And it's not journalism. It's theater.
This American Life wasn't the only journalistic outlet for Daisy. For the past year, he's been in the news constantly. Newspaper articles, op-eds, magazine profiles, online news sites. He's made numerous television appearances, CNN, C-SPAN, Bill Maher. And he usually says things like this from an appearance on MSNBC a month ago.
I saw all the things that everyone's been reporting on. I saw underage workers. I talked to workers who were 13, 14, 15 years old. I met people whose hands have been destroyed from doing the same motion again and again on the line.
Making Apple products.
Yes.
What makes this complicated is that the things Daisy lied about seeing are things that have actually happened in China. Workers making Apple products have been poisoned by hexane. Apple's own audits show the company has caught underage workers at a handful of its suppliers. These things are rare, but together they form an easy-to-understand narrative about Apple.
People like a very simple narrative.
Adam Minter is a columnist for the financial news service Bloomberg. He spent years visiting more than 150 Chinese factories. He's writing a book about the global recycling industry. He says the reality of factory conditions in China is complicated. Working at Foxconn can be grueling, but most workers will tell you they're happy to have the job. He says Daisy's become a media darling because he's used an emotional performance to focus on a much simpler message.
Foxconn bad. iPhone bad. You know, sign a petition, now you're good. That's a great, simple message, and it's going to resonate with a public radio listener. It's going to resonate with a New York Times reader, and I think that's one of the reasons why he's had so much traction.
And Minter says the fact that Daisy has not told the truth to people about what he saw in China won't have much of an impact on how the public sees this issue. and Apple will continue to try to clean up its image. The company's hired an independent auditor to inspect its suppliers throughout China. Charles Duhigg is a New York Times reporter who helped write an investigative series on Apple's supply chain. He told us that it may be hard to track whether conditions are improving because Apple hasn't yet released data that can be compared on a year-by-year basis.
My understanding is that Apple has said that they are going to begin releasing essentially granular data. And so we're looking for that to test the claims that things are improving as a result of Apple going in and demanding changes.
And if Apple does become more transparent about its supply chain, that could mean a step towards better working conditions, something Mike Daisy has been fighting for all along. From Shenzhen, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Okay, so that's it, the inaugural edition of the ReMarket podcast. I'm Deborah Clark. Thanks.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.